Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be exploring some interesting territory today, and territory that is very much unknown to me. It involves forensics work. And the reason for the conversation is a really exciting addition to the scientific offerings at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, namely a new forensics and molecular anthropology lab. And this lab will be engaged in primarily this matter of human identification and DNA extraction, fascinating, complex work. And managing this brand new lab is Dr. Keith Biddle, who is Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. He is a forensic and molecular anthropologist, and we are going to be talking for the next few minutes about the work that he does and the kind of areas that are explored when one studies this, and what this new lab means for present and future students at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And thanks to the treacherous road conditions out there, and it is indeed treacherous, Dr. Keith Biddle is joining us over the telephone for today's morning show conversation. Professor Biddle, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad we can have this conversation, even if it's not face-to-face. I'm glad you're safe and sound in your home. Let's talk for a moment, first of all, about where you're from originally and at what point in your life this particular avenue of science became of interest to you.
Sure. So originally, I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri. And when I first went to college, I thought I wanted to be an English teacher, And I didn't even know about anthropology, really, until I got into some upper-level classes, and I took a course in Introduction to Biological Anthropology, and I just fell in love with it. It just felt, kind of like coming home, if that makes any sense.
Hmm.
So I went to my professor, and I said, how does one make a living doing this? And she said, you don't. And I, was really kind of disappointed, and she must have seen that on my face. And she said, take my forensic anthropology class in the spring. And this was at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. And so I did. And as part of that, there was a guest lecturer came to talk to us. She was a medical legal death investigator with the St. Louis County Medical Examiner's Office. And she gave her guest lecture. And afterwards, I was talking to her, and she invited me to tour their facility, the crime lab there in St. Louis County. And I did. And I started doing an internship. And I found that all of the sights and smells of the work didn't bother me, and I just found it absolutely fascinating. It's like a puzzle piece. It just fit. Oh. And so I knew that to get a job in forensics, one needs an advanced degree. And I was a little older than most traditional college students at the time, so I spent a little bit of time, you know, letting my kids grow up. I didn't go to grad school immediately. I took a few years off, but I knew that that's what I wanted to do. So eventually, I applied to graduate school. I applied to a few different graduate schools and was accepted to the University of Montana. And so in 2017, I picked up and moved my family halfway across the country from St. Louis to Missoula, Montana, and spent the next 6 years and in the mountains. And first, I got my master's degree in forensic anthropology, which took 2 years, as most master's programs do. And then I was just going to go get a job at a medical examiner's office as like I said, a medical legal death investigator, and was interviewing with a lab down in San Diego when the Montana State Crime Lab called us, my advisor, and the lady that ended up being my PhD advisor, and said, we have this project in mind. Would anybody be interested? Do you have a student that might be interested in doing this? So we met with them, and I met with my wife, and I met with, you know, thought about it and mulled it over and decided to stay on and get my PhD doing this project. And I got my PhD in 3.5 years, which is absolute insanity. And I don't recommend that anybody else do that, but I had my reasons. I had a family, and I had my reasons for hustling to get through it. So that's kind of, and then after I graduated in December of 2023 with my PhD, and was offered the job here in Kenosha, and decided that I love teaching and I love forensics, and they wanted somebody that could do both things, and they wanted somebody that could expand their curriculum and possibly build a lab. And they even had a space that they were willing to offer me to a physical space for the lab. And so I accepted the offer and came out here and have been working to get my space ready and get everything built up, and also get my, you know, student base built up. And so I've been in Kenosha for all of one semester, but it's been great so far.
Wonderful. Just so glad to hear that. Ahead of us, you making the move out to UW Parkside. My understanding from something I read is that while you were pursuing the final leg of your education, you actually ended up doing some work as a consultant with both the FBI and the U.S. State Department. Maybe there's a limit to how much you can actually say about that, but tell us whatever you can about what kind of work that turned out to be.
Sure. So one of the things that drew me to the University of Montana as a grad student is that they are unique in that they offer their grad students the opportunity to do and work on actual forensic anthropological casework. And what that entails is when someone dies out in the wilderness, which happens more often than people might think, or they go missing and then human remains are found, they call out a forensic anthropologist. We go collect all as many of the bones as we can, and we try to identify them by their bones. That's the whole goal of forensic anthropology. And at Montana, they allow the grad students to work under the supervision of a PhD professor. They allow the students to do these forensic this casework. And so the very first case that I was assigned to in Montana was a case that the U.S. State Department wanted to exhume this body of someone that had worked for them back in the 70s and 80s. And so we did that, and that's the kind of consultative work that I did for them. And then also with the FBI, they have task forces, you know, missing persons task forces, human trafficking task forces, those kinds of things. And I was able to, in some of my casework at that university as a grad student, work on some of those cases, excuse me, where the FBI was interested in, was this person a victim of human trafficking and that sort of thing. So I've gotten to work with law enforcement from municipal departments. I did that in St. Louis as well as in Missoula, and as all the way through state police, tribal police, and a host of federal agencies in that kind of consultative sort of capacity.
Wonderful. We're speaking with Dr. Keith Biddle, who is a member of the faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, assistant professor of criminal justice and anthropology, and he is going to be serving, or is serving, as the lab manager for Parkside's new Human Identification and Forensic Anthropology Lab. So when UW-Parkside offered up this opportunity, tell us what was in place in terms of the program that is related to the work that that you have been doing, and in a sense, what you are charged with in terms of expanding that.
Sure. So Parkside has long offered a course, an undergraduate course in forensic anthropology, taught by Dr. Bob Sasso, who is really more of an archaeologist. He doesn't mind teaching the class, but it's not really his wheelhouse. And they realize that forensics and forensic anthropology is a growing field. And Parkside is very dedicated to developing programs which will help students get prepared for the real world, prepared for a career. And so realizing that forensics is a growing field, they really wanted somebody who could help develop that, because they didn't have a whole lot in place. There was a course, there's a course that was offered before I got here in the summertime. It was offered as kind of a medical legal death investigation, crime scene investigation type of class. And that had gotten a good response. It's also offered through continuing ed, so law enforcement and other people can come and get continuing education credits for it. And they really just wanted to expand that. And as far as the DNA aspect of it, there was nothing in place at Parkside. And so I think when I applied, they saw this opportunity to really develop this and go beyond what they had before. So, they wanted somebody to teach forensic anthropology and human evolution classes and those kinds of classes that was, you know, a specialist rather than somebody that's doing it just because they needed somebody to teach it. So that's kind of what I came into. Again, they had a lab that I could use, but it was not originally a DNA lab. So that is being built from the ground up.
Very good. That lab is being built now? I mean, like, even as we speak?
Well, they had a space available for me. Some tweaks had to be made because the space itself used to be a geology lab. And the professor that was using it and teaching it retired. And they knew that was happening, so they offered me that space. So I had to clean out that space and gut that space. And again, get it ready to be a DNA lab, and it is ready. It is ready to go. I have everything that I need, and it's been sanitized and sterilized and turned from a geology lab into a fully functional DNA lab.
Great. I'm excited to talk with you about some of the specifics of this facet of the work. I want to ask you a question that might seem a little strange, but I think it might help bring some clarity to all of this. You are a assistant professor of criminal justice and anthropology, and I think most of us really easily understand the criminal justice piece of this. I mean, how this kind of work that you do folds very nicely into the field of criminal justice. Anthropology is a more complicated term, and it's a term that we often use in arenas or contexts that have nothing to do with really what we're talking about today or the kind of work that happens in this specific lab. Can you kind of help us understand a little more comprehensively the world of anthropology and then what facet of that world we're talking about this morning?
Sure. So anthropology really just means literally the study of humans, of humankind. That's literally what the word means. And anthropology as a field, we like to say that it is a four-field discipline in that you have cultural anthropology, which studies different cultures from around the globe and through different time periods. You have archaeology, which falls under anthropology, and I think most people kind of have an idea of what archaeology is. You know, you're digging in the dirt, you're digging up artifacts, physical culture, you know, artifacts and buildings and things like that. And then there's also linguistic anthropology, which studies human language and how, you know, all the different intricacies of human language. And then you have biological anthropology, which studies human evolution and primates. And then you have under that, you also have forensic anthropology, which takes a forensic anthropologist uses very specialized knowledge of the human skeletal system, how it works, how it's changed through time, how we've become what we are today. And we use that to help identify humans that have passed away that we don't have any other way of identifying. So a lot of times, you know, somebody will pass away and we don't have a driver's license, or even if we have a driver's license, we can't necessarily rely on that. And we use the skeletal system, the bones, to help build what we call a biological profile of the individual. We look at we measure their bones to figure out how tall they were in life, their stature. We look at aspects of their bones to see if they were biologically male or biologically female, if they had undergone the changes necessary to allow for a child to pass through the birth canal, and how old they were at the time that they passed away, their age at death. We also look at indications of pathology, how healthy or did they have specific illnesses which affected the skeleton. Did they have any trauma to the skeleton? We are also skilled and trained in identifying different kinds of trauma that can happen to bones. Bones break in specific ways. They take damage in specific ways, and we are very, very good at identifying those specific types of damage that we see to bone. And all of this can be then used to help. We hold this up. We give it to law enforcement, and they hold it up to missing persons reports, and they say, do we have any missing persons that fit this biological profile? And then molecular anthropology takes that one step further, because sometimes we still can't necessarily identify them. So we take the DNA from the bones, from the teeth, and we can help identify them that way. If we have a reference sample from a family member or a reference sample that's already been uploaded into any one of a number of different kinds of databases to help identify these unknown individuals. We also work a lot with cold cases as well as historic cases.
We're speaking with Dr. Keith Biddle, who is Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And he is the manager of Parkside's new Human Identification and Forensic Anthropology Lab. He has just come to Parkside. He is in the middle of his very first year there. Professor Biddle, explain what was most necessary to equip this new human identification and forensic anthropology lab. And I think you've maybe touched or mentioned, at least in passing, maybe a part of this answer already. But what kind of equipment in particular, and maybe what also sort of physical apparatus and setup was necessary to put in place so students at Parkside could do this kind of work in maybe better, more sort of authentic fashion?
Sure. I focus on DNA extraction from the human bones and teeth. So I'm not getting too deep yet, and I stress yet, into the genetic analysis of the DNA that requires machinery and chemicals, which right now is beyond my budget. But just to get to do the DNA extraction, you need to have a way to get the DNA from the bone tissue. So first, I use a drill to get some bone powder, and I have to do it in a sanitized and sterilized space so that I'm not contaminating any DNA that I might get with my own DNA, and there's no contamination from the environment, bacterial contamination or DNA from students or anybody else that might get in the way of the DNA from the person we're trying to identify. So I had to have a little box, essentially, is what it boils down to, where I can actually drill the bones to get the DNA in a sterilized environment. The equipment that I use for the DNA extraction, the chemical process, it's pretty basic scientific stuff. A couple little centrifuges and what we call a cross linker, which is a high intensity ultraviolet light. It kind of looks like a microwave, and I put my test tubes and some equipment in there, and I turn it on, and the ultraviolet light helps sterilize and neutralize any other DNA that might be on the equipment, so that I can do the chemical extractions and not worry about any contamination. If I were doing, it's not necessary for the space to be completely sterile, 100% sterile, for the type of work that I'm doing. If I were working with ancient samples and very, very old samples, then the entire space that I would need to use would have to be environmentally independent from the rest of the building and positively charged and have airflow parameters and things like that. And I don't need to worry too much about that. So the space that I was given is actually quite perfect. It's small, but it suits my needs, and it allows me to have students come in and learn how to do this and decide if this is what they want to do, what they want to continue on. They want to continue on in forensics, or if they maybe want to branch out and do something different. But either way, it will give them, you know, real hands-on laboratory experience working with very expensive chemicals and pretty sensitive equipment, scientific equipment, at least a fundamental level, and they can decide then if they want to pursue that. And I have a feeling a lot of them will. Our students at Parkside are pretty motivated and smart kids, smart students, and there's been a ton of interest in what I do. So I'm excited, and I think the departments are excited as well.
I'm curious about the distinction that you just drew between work that, in a sense, is anchored in the present day versus if you were doing the kind of work that involves analyzing human remains from, you know, maybe centuries ago or whatever, that mm-hmm. that would involve a very different situation in terms of what the lab would have to be and the conditions needing to be, in a sense, much more pristine and sterile. I'm just curious why that mm-hmm. is the case. What is the reason behind that careful distinction?
The reason is that DNA can be a very fragile molecule. Hmm. And as it's exposed to environmental conditions after death, during life, our DNA, if something goes wrong with our DNA, which it does frequently, most of the time our bodies fix it, and we never know that anything happened. When things do go wrong and it doesn't get fixed, that's when you end up with things like cancer. But DNA, so DNA can be a very fragile molecule, especially after death or post-mortem. And lots of things can damage that DNA, and it can get the strand itself, you know, everybody thinks of DNA as that double-stranded helix, right? It can get broken, and it does get broken. And so when you go to extract that DNA from ancient bones and very, very old samples or very damaged samples, you have to be very careful that you're not contaminating it, that you're not adding anything else from the environment to those samples. You have to use very specific primers and other things so that we can amplify those very small broken fragments that have occurred because of the age of the DNA and the damage that it has sustained in its time since the individual passed away.
Hmm. When you are working in the lab, what kind of remains are you working on, and where do those remains come from? I mean, are you working with actual human remains, or is it possible to create, in a sense, synthetic human remains that, you know, serve the same sort of educational purpose?
I am actually working with human remains, and these are remains that can come from a variety of cases, for lack of a better term. Some is going to be historic because people will move cemeteries or things like that. So and bodies get exhumed, and they want a profile, they want some identification that way. So there's some historic aspect of it, and we're talking a couple hundred years versus, you know, like thousands of years. And I can do, you know, historic up to a couple hundred years. A lot of it is going to be modern cases where they don't know who these remains belong to. So these are people who may have passed away within the last 10 years. And then we also might have cold cases where, you know, remains were found before DNA was really available, or before it was as accurate and as it is now. The science of DNA has come a long way, and our understanding of DNA has come a long way, even in the last 7 years since I've been a grad student, but definitely in the last, you know, 30 years in my lifetime. And so a lot of these, the cases, the cold cases, have been sitting on a shelf and waiting for somebody to identify them. And there's been a new technology that's called forensic investigative genetic genealogy, which has come about in the last, I don't know, dozen years or so, especially the last 6 or 7 years, that has gotten a lot of attention in the media. But they still need to get the DNA first in order to run those forensic genetic genealogy tests. So that's where I come in, and doing a biological profile and then getting some DNA from these bones to be able to identify these people. But most of the cases that I'm working on involve real human remains, and knowing where the best places to get DNA from the skeleton are, because DNA isn't uniformly spread throughout the skeleton, and then getting these people identified. And I think as far as the Parkside students go, using any kind of a synthetic proxy would only do so much for them, as far as learning how to pipette chemicals precisely from one dish into another, or one tube into another. But the fact that you know, they will be assisting in learning how to do this with real remains and real cases adds a layer to their education, that if they want to work in the real world doing this, they're gonna need to be prepared to work under these conditions.
So how is it that these human remains find their way to your lab? I mean, have you had to, for instance, establish some kind of relationship with, for instance, local law enforcement? I mean, is that an avenue through mm-hmm. which these remains come to you? Or otherwise, I mean, how are you, in a sense, laying your hands on these remains that you and your students can work with?
Yeah, that's a kind of exactly how they come to me, is through a chain of custody, through law enforcement, through medical examiners and coroner's offices. You know, we have to assume that these are potentially the results could possibly involve criminal cases and have legal ramifications. They usually don't. Usually what I'm doing is just identifying the person. But law enforcement and medical examiners, coroner's offices, I will either go to their office. I can travel to do the sampling and actually collect the bone powder or tooth powder that I need, and then take it back to my lab. Or we can arrange for me to bring them to the lab, or they can bring them to the lab. Those are the kinds of details building up the lab that still need to get worked out and will often be worked out on a case-by-case basis, or by the preferences of the jurisdiction. For example, Kenosha County might have a different protocol than Racine County or Milwaukee County. So I have to be sensitive to their jurisdictional desires and protocols. But I can travel to them and procure the bone powder, or they can come to me. I prefer them to come to me, the remains to come to me, but that's not always possible. Hmm. So, again, still building this lab up and still being new to town, all of those are the kinds of details that will get worked out and hammered out, like I said, mostly on a case-by-case basis. There are private labs that have been in touch with me and I have ongoing conversations with about how to actually get me remains that they would like for me to sample across the country. It is possible to ship those things under the right conditions. So that is rare, but it does happen.
As you're describing this, I'm realizing now, I imagined a scenario in which you were, in a sense, asking for a favor. You have this lab, you have students that need to learn how to do this, and so I imagined you going to criminal justice jurisdictions of one kind or another and saying, could you please give us something that we could work on? As you describe this, it really sounds more like you are providing a service. I mean, that you are doing this work, in a sense, for real, not just for the sake of educating your students, but also doing actual analysis that is going to be utilized.
Absolutely.
Now, in most cases, is it your analysis alone, or are you being brought in as sort of a second opinion, or does the analysis that happens in your lab, will that stand? I mean, as the, in a sense, official results for a given case.
So my forensic anthropological examinations, if a medical examiner's office contacts me and they've got a skeleton and they want me to do just a forensic anthropological analysis of it and try to get a biological profile, then my analysis can stand on its own. And as a forensic anthropologist, I have not yet, but I have to be prepared to testify as an expert witness in court to my findings.
Wow.
The DNA side of things is a little different. Because I'm not equipped to actually do the DNA analysis, I'm only equipped to do the extraction at this particular point until, we build the lab up a little bit. That's all I'm doing with the DNA, and then I send the extracted DNA to the lab. Actually, I still work very closely with the lab in Montana, at the University of Montana, who can do the actual DNA analysis, and then they send me their results. So for the forensic anthropology, my findings stand alone. As far as the DNA goes, I'm sort of the starting point. the thing about that is that if you don't have a good starting point, then all of the results are going to be less than ideal. So having that basis and having that good starting point is key to getting good results from a DNA in a DNA analysis.
We're speaking with Dr. Keith Biddle, who is a member of the faculty at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. Parkside now has a new human identification and forensic anthropology lab. And Dr. Biddle serves as manager of that lab, and he is an assistant professor of criminal justice and anthropology at UW-Parkside. He is in the middle of his first year there. Professor Biddle, my understanding is that the focus of your PhD is on basically the best places, the optimal places in the human body from which to extract DNA. And I think we're really talking about extraction from the bones of the body. As I read that, I found myself really surprised, because I think a lot of us would just assume that human bone is human bone, and that it wouldn't matter a whole lot from which bones you are drawing your samples. So would love to know a little bit more about just kind of how wide a variant we are talking about, and when it comes to certain places being better to utilize, certain places in the body being better to utilize for that, you know, why that is. Tell us more about this.
Sure. So your bones are alive. It's kind of when I was going to school back in the old days, I was not taught very much about, you know, the biology of human bones. And I kind of thought that they were almost like the studs in your walls. You know, they just held you up. That's not the case. Bones are alive, and they play a very vital role in your overall health. And there are cells in your bones, just like there are in your skin, in your hair, in your blood. And there are different kinds of cells in your bones, and they don't all congregate uniformly through all of your bones or your teeth. And so it used to be, and to some degree is still the case, that when we wanted to get DNA from bone, we would take a huge sample of bone with a saw or a drill and hope for the best when it came to a DNA analysis. And that has really fallen out of favor lately over the past few years, because the truth is we really don't need to do that. If we know where the cells are most active in the bones at any given time in a person's life, which they will leave evidence for us, we can target those areas, and we can not destroy so much bone tissue, because nobody wants to destroy any more human remains than absolutely possible or absolutely necessary. And a big part of my PhD dissertation was finding these places on the skeleton where the cells are the most active, and targeting those areas and using a very small amount of bone powder, a very small, limited amount of destruction of human remains, in order to target where are the best places to get DNA when we have human bones in good condition and human bones in not so good condition. It's something that is a relatively new aspect to DNA extraction from human bones and the analysis of those extractions. And there are a lot of professionals in the field who are very interested in this. And I presented some of my research in February of 22 at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences convention, and I'm doing it again this coming February, going to Denver to present some more of my research to the anthropology as well as the criminalistic section of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. And I'm working with lots of different professionals. I've worked with people from British Columbia and Los Angeles County and obviously quite a few in Montana, who are very interested in this research. Oh, also Virginia, who are very interested in this and in limiting the amount of destruction that we have to do in order to get a good good DNA result.
I'm curious, when you did this study for your PhD, did you end up making your determinations by extracting from different parts of the body and studying the results? Mm-hmm. I mean, was that the pathway to coming to this understanding, or were you able to kind of ascertain your results from some other way?
Nope. It was all done with firsthand research. I was doing the sampling and doing the DNA extractions and doing the analysis. And we worked with the Missoula County medical examiner and medical examiner for the state of Montana. And they were able to provide a body for me to use. We got next of kin permission from this individual's, I want to say it was the nephew, to do this study. And the individuals, I took over about 400 samples from the skeleton of this individual, and targeted different areas and then compared the DNA results to not only the, so for example, on the humerus, which is the upper arm bone, I took, 8 samples from each humerus, the left and the right, using different bone tissue, because your bones also have, there are different kinds of bone tissue. And so that way I was able to kind of correlate what kind of DNA we got, as well as where on that bone, and then where at that specific site. And then, was it different between the right and the left bone? Was it different between closer to the shoulder or closer to the elbow? And using some actually fairly basic statistical analyses. I know statistics, they are important. But I was able to get a good idea of where we wanted to drill. For example, if we wanted to do mitochondrial DNA, which is kind of a different kind of DNA, or if we wanted to do autosomal DNA, which is like if you want to do an STR profile, which is what they always talk about on CSI, and that's what we use in CODIS and in criminal cases. But mitochondrial DNA can be very important as far as matching relatives together. I would want to go to a different site possibly if I wanted mitochondrial DNA or if I wanted autosomal DNA. And my dissertation, I was able to use real human bones and that had been obtained very ethically, and that was important to us. The ethics of how to go about doing this in an ethical way is very, very important to us. Again, we don't want to destroy any more bone tissue than we absolutely have to. And we want to make sure that we are being transparent as far as our research. The next of kin had the right to, and has the right to, withdraw consent at any point. They can say, nope, stop, we want the remains back, we want to bury them. And they are more than welcome to do that, to exercise that right. So a lot of this has to do with the ethics of how to treat the deceased ethically, while still being able to provide some good answers as far as who they are, and understanding that sometimes destructive analysis is necessary to get an identification, but limiting it to only what we have to do.
Hmm. What do the results look like when you have done this kind of analysis? I mean, what comes up? Is it a series of numbers? Is it some kind of a graph? Is it some sort of what would it look like? And would that make any sense whatsoever to the uninitiated amateur in the general public?
No, it probably wouldn't. It is graphs, it is numbers, it is all of the above. But no, it probably wouldn't make much sense to somebody that didn't know what they were looking at. They would just see a bunch of lines and a bunch of pretty colors and a bunch of numbers, and these numbers can look very strange. For example, with, you know, when we get a quantitation, when we do DNA quantitation, we get a number that is, for example, 6.07 × 10⁻⁸.
Wow.
And a lot of times people look at that, and if you don't know what you're looking at, you're like, what does that mean? You know, and why is that such a small number? But we're dealing with molecular weight and molecules of DNA. So, yes, they're very small numbers, but, you know, and then we take that and we say, yeah, but we still got a full DNA profile on it, and we show the DNA. When I show my students the actual DNA profile and what it actually looks like, it's a graph with a bunch of squiggly lines and hills and valleys. And once I explain it to them, obviously they understand it. But if you don't have somebody to explain it to you, it just looks like a lot of pretty colors and a weird little graph. So.
Well, of course, tied up in that pretty little graph is a lot of important and often significant and helpful information, and the work of extracting that information is in no way simple. And of course, the good work that you are doing to help educate Parkside students to be able to do this is valuable indeed. Just in our last minute or so, I'd like you to just kind of summarize where you hope things will go from here, and in particular your goals in terms of the expansion and deepening of this program at Parkside.
Absolutely. Right now my goal is to be able to help the local law enforcement community, the local forensic community, ME's offices, coroner's offices, with identifying any cases that they might have of unknown individuals. And that is my primary goal, is to be of service and to be useful and help get these people identified and sent home to their relatives, to their communities, whatever that may be, whatever that may look like. And while I'm doing it, to teach Parkside students and to use this as an opportunity so that they can learn about forensics and the real world of forensics and what forensic science and forensic anthropology and DNA all looks like, to decide if they want a career in this field or something adjacent to it, perhaps. And then down the line, since I'm only involved with the extraction right now, I would love to be able to develop this into a full lab that is capable of DNA quantitation and DNA analysis. And that's going to require, unfortunately, a lot of money. Those are very expensive machines and chemicals and reagents. And so I will be applying for lots of grants to be able to get that funding and just expand my capabilities and expand. And the more I can do that, the more students I can teach and the more that I can teach them so that they can decide, you know, again, if this is something that they really want to do. And a lot of them may decide that it is. And they may decide that that experience would be better served in corporate aspects of the community, like SC Johnson or any of the other chemical manufacturing companies or pharmaceutical companies that we have here. So the skills in my lab that they learn can translate into other fields as well as forensics. So that's my goal. Short term is just to help and teach. And long term is to be able to expand my capacity to help and teach more, because I love forensic anthropology and I love DNA and I love talking about it and seeing my students have their minds blown when they realize the reality of this situation. So I'm having a lot of fun doing this.
I can tell. Dr. Keith Biddle, a forensic and molecular anthropologist and assistant professor of criminal justice and anthropology at UW Parkside. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for your time and very best wishes to you.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I appreciate it.
We'll talk again soon. Thank you again. We're approaching 9 o'clock. We remind you a winter weather advisory is in effect until 2 p.m. We do expect our temperatures to rise to 36, but for now, we still have some very treacherous driving conditions out there, so do take care. Overnight, low of 32. Tomorrow's high, 39 degrees with rain and fog. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Basin, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva, NPR News and